Well, thank you sincerely for that beautiful message and song. Good morning and happy Sabbath. In Testimonies Volume 9, we are told we are living at the time of the end. The fast fulfilling signs of the times declare that the coming of Christ is near at hand. The days in which we live are solemn and important. The Spirit of God is gradually but surely being withdrawn from the earth. The agencies of evil are combining their forces and consolidating. They are strengthening for the last great crisis. Great changes are soon to take place in our world, and the final movements will be rapid ones. It was a glorious day in our nation's capital. Summer's warmth still lingered in the air, but the sky already looked like fall, a clear and crisp view as far as the eye could see. And from Arlington, Virginia, you could see the entire city, the white cupola of our nation's capital building glowing in the last of summer's sunlight. The proud spire of the Washington Monument and the odd rolling shape of RFK Stadium far to the east. It was September 11, 2001. And I was on the phone when I heard the odd sound of jet engines screaming at full throttle. Now, it's not an unusual sound. And at first, I didn't think much of it. In Arlington, Virginia, we're just up the hill from the Pentagon. Marine One flew by nearly every day. The runway for Reagan National Airport was just out of sight, a couple of miles to the southeast. And so jet engines are not an uncommon thing to hear in that city. But as they grew louder and louder, I began to become worried, thinking that perhaps an airliner was having mechanical problems and trying to return to the runway at Reagan National Airport. Or perhaps, I thought, a young fighter pilot, long on enthusiasm and short on sense for his career, had decided to give the bosses at the Pentagon a close haircut. But then, as my building began to physically shake, as the aircraft got closer and closer, I dropped the phone and ran to the window in time to see an enormous Boeing 757-200, its engine screaming at full throttle and bearing the familiar colors of American Airlines, come right over my window, drop down, clip the top of a tree that grew just in front of it, bank slightly to the left as though it was headed for the White House, and then make an abrupt, sudden right turn and dive into the ground just short of the western fifth wedge of the Pentagon, and I watched as that large airliner plowed right into the side of the building and disappeared. I saw the fireball, and a few seconds later, I felt the concussion as the shockwave reached my windows. And by that time, I'd already grabbed my cap and was running down Columbia Pike towards the headquarters of the most powerful military the world has ever seen. And as I ran, I joined up with a company of Marines boiling out of Henderson Hall. There was a young Butterbar second lieutenant jogging next to me. I said, "Lieutenant, where are our fighters? Where are the F-15s?" He said, "Sir, my best information is that we do not have air cover. All we have is helicopters from Andrews Air Force Base." And sure enough, as I looked across the Potomac River, I could see the first Black Hawk beginning to head towards the Pentagon. And for over 40 minutes, we were in that building pulling out the first casualties of what's now known as America's Global War on Terror. I was carrying a major out who had a bad gash on his forehead. And I don't think the news reported it, but Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was on the ground that day. In fact, he'd been in the building when the airliner hit and was standing close to the impact point, coordinating rescue efforts, one might say. For the most part, he was in our way, but it was nice to see the boss cared and was on the ground with us. And then I saw a security detail get on their earpieces. They literally picked him up, physically threw him into the back of an SUV and took off. And I thought, well, that can't be good. And it wasn't. A couple minutes later, a Pentagon security vehicle pulled up and said, "Everybody evacuate back to Henderson Hall now. We have another airliner inbound for the nation's capital. Probable target is the Pentagon. Pull back immediately." And so all of us that had been there trying to help pull people out of that building started back up the hill. And as we were running up the hill, trying to get out of what we now know as the path of Flight 93 that ultimately crashed in Pennsylvania, we saw a press reporter coming down the hill. He'd parked as close as he could get and was trying to find the Pentagon. You could see the plume of smoke from the impact point, but you couldn't see the building because of the terrain feature. And he asked me as he's running towards the building, he said, is the Pentagon that way? I said, yes, sir, it is. But if you would like to report the news rather than make it, I suggest you stay here for the next few minutes. And so about 5-10 minutes later, we received word that we were clear to go back in. And I'll never forget the most memorable sight I saw that day. As again, I was coming out of the southern access door to the fifth wedge of the Pentagon, helping another Army officer out who was having trouble seeing due to flash burns. I heard everybody screaming and cheering and pointing east towards RFK Stadium. I turned to look, and right out of that beautiful clear blue sky was an F-16 Charlie, a Viper, down low and slow, doing a radar sweep all the way around the District of Columbia. And you could watch him as he circled around northeast, northwest, over the spires of Georgetown University, and then you could hear that big Pratt & Whitney engine beginning to howl itself as he kicked in full military power and started flying right towards us. And by the time he flew through that plume of smoke that was the headstone for 125 individuals, he had his burner lit. He dipped a wing, pulled up in a chandelle, and assumed high top cover over the city. And about 15, 20 minutes after he arrived, you began hearing the supersonic booms of F-15 Eagles, or at that time, premier air superiority fighter, arriving over Washington. Well, turns out the Air Force had a plan to repel any sort of airborne attack against the continental United States, in general, the capital in particular. Unfortunately, it hadn't been updated since we were worried about Soviet bombers flying over the Atlantic Ocean. And so when the scramble order came, our Alert 5 and Alert 15 aircraft took off, did what the F-15 Eagle does best. They kicked in burners, rocketed straight up to 90,000 feet and shot out to sea, got there, looked on the radar scopes and started calling air traffic control saying, we don't have any bogeys, where's the enemy? By that point, they had to stop and refuel before they could make a high-speed dash back to the U.S. And as it turned out, the first Air Force unit over the Capitol was an Air National Guard F-16 off of Langley Air Force Base in Southern Virginia. But I'll tell you, there's no feeling in the world better than seeing one come overhead when you've been without air cover for the better part of an hour. Well, as the afternoon wore on, professional rescue crews showed up. The Pentagon's own rescue squad had been unfortunately wiped out. They were stationed right in the area that was impacted by Flight 77. And as Fairfax and other local Virginia heavy rescue and fire squads began to show up, we were finally released. And not having much to do with myself, I finally decided to head into the city and visit a friend. And as I went, I turned on the radio and I heard our congressional representative standing on the steps of the Capitol building, where Republicans and Democrats together had gathered to inform their country that the People's House would be open the next day and the people's business would go forward. And when they were done with that press conference, they all burst into an impromptu rendition of God Bless America. I can't say that our congressional representatives are necessarily elected for their singing ability, but I can say that on that day and at that hour, with the smoke of the Pentagon still in my hair and the pain of flash burns on my arms and face, that song never sounded better to me. God bless America, indeed. It is 9 years now and a lifetime of history since that fall morning, and so much in this country and in our lives has changed. But the questions posed by that day still linger and are being debated today. What does it mean to a nation to guarantee the very liberties our enemies wrap themselves in while they are trying to destroy us? Can we effectively shoot at our foes without hitting the Constitution? What does it mean to guarantee religious liberty for everyone and allow everyone to exercise their faith as they see fit, where they choose, when they choose, because they choose to do so? Well, this morning, on the anniversary of a day that changed all of our lives, I would like to share with you some thoughts about religious liberty in America. Where to begin on that topic? Well, many would start the story with the framers of the Constitution and that hot summer in Philadelphia where representatives from the 12 states sat down and suffered through the heat and the blue bottle flies to wrest from time and history a document whose simple ideals have become a beacon for so much of what is good about the human spirit. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure to ourselves and to our posterity the blessings of liberty, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution. Now, if you're ever in Washington, D.C., and you have time to stop by the National Archives to see that document today, you will see it is old and faded and in many parts barely legible. But on that day, 234 years ago, when it was signed, it was bright and new, fresh quill ink on shiny parchment, a dream and an experiment in the first form of government to put the rights of its people first. President Reagan put it this way: the culmination of men's dreams for 6,000 years were formalized with the Constitution, probably the most unique document ever drawn in the long history of man's relation to man. Other constitutions say government grants you these rights. Ours says you are born with these rights. They are yours by the grace of God, and no government on earth can take them away from you. Within just a few years, that principle would be put to the test, and Americans would show the world what they meant when they signed that document. It happened like this. It was 1850, and there was a young guy named Martin Kosha who had come to New York City and started the paperwork to become a U.S. citizen. He was a Hungarian revolutionary that had fought against the Austrians, and 2 years after moving to New York, he went back to Turkey to attend to some business matters. While there, a large Austrian flotilla was in the harbor at Smyrna. They discovered who he was, and they sent a party of Austrian marines ashore to seize Kostya so that they could take him back to Austria and hang him. Well, he was taken aboard a large Austrian ship of the line, a ship of war named the Hussar, and found himself a prisoner without a country, not a U.S. citizen, a wanted criminal about to be hanged, alone and in chains. Well, shortly thereafter, a small American sloop of war, the USS St. Louis, sailed into the same harbor at Smyrna under the command of a young guy named Commander Duncan Ingram. When Commander Ingram learned from one of Kostya's friends who had seen the flag on that ship, and he didn't really know much about Kostya, but he knew that Kostya had pointed to the American flag and said, "I will be a citizen of that country," that man went to Commander Ingram and he said, "Commander, you got to do something. My friend is in chains aboard that Austrian warship." So Commander Ingram rode over to the Hussar and demanded to see Mr. Kostya. And the Austrian admiral, the commander of the flotilla, somewhat amused, thought, "I might as well humor this yank." And so they hauled Kostya up onto the deck in chains. And Commander Ingram said to the Austrian admiral, "Admiral, I will be able to converse with my citizen much better if those chains are removed." So once again, the admiral humored him and took the chains off. And Commander Ingram walked over to Kostya, leaned over, and he said, "Son, I'm going to ask you one question, and I want you to think very carefully before you answer it because it's important. Do you request the assistance of the American flag?" And Kostya nodded, and the captain said, "You shall have it." Later that day, three more Austrian warships came into the harbor. Nevertheless, Commander Ingram told the Austrians that if they did not turn Kostya over, he would use all the force at his disposal to protect that American life. One little sloop against four warships, 20 guns against 33, 200 men against 600. As the hour neared and the Austrian fleet began to weigh anchor and prepare to leave the harbor, the USS Ingram sailed out to the mouth of the harbor, beat to colors, ran out its guns, loaded the cannons, lit their tapers, and prepared to go to war for a man who was not even yet a full American citizen. And at the last minute, as the tapers neared the powder and the cannons were ready to fire, a small rowboat was lowered from the side of the Hussar and Kostya came back to the USS St. Louis. That day, Commander Ingram penned his resignation from the U.S. Navy, saying, "I did what I thought my oath of office required, but if I have embarrassed my country in any way, I hereby resign my commission." Well, that resignation was forwarded to the United States Senate for consideration, and in unanimously rejecting it, the U.S. Senate used these words: "This battle that was never fought may turn out to be the most important battle in our nation's history." That is the American dream. No matter how great the cost or how high the price, every one of us is committed to the rights and liberties of the very least among us. And that is a dream that was enthusiastically embraced by the early Adventist church at a time before the Civil War, when it was very unpopular to do so. Captain Joseph Bates, a sea captain himself, went down to the state of Maryland to preach to the slaves that were at that point still considered items of property of their owners in the state of Maryland. And as he went down there, one of the slave owners came to him. He said, "Captain Bates, are you here to free our slaves?" Abolitionists were not very popular in the South at that time. And Captain Bates said, "Sir, all of us are slaves to sin. I am here to free you and your slaves." Well, I think to begin, however, our story of religious liberty in America with the drafting of the Constitution begins the story over 100 years too late. Because you see, before there was a Constitution, before there was a revolution, before there was America, the people that came to this country came here to flee, many of them, religious persecution in the old world. And it is in that story that the first seeds of the grand American experiment begin to take shape. Unfortunately, once they got here, the first thing that most of those persecuted folk did was to turn around and immediately begin persecuting themselves, others who did not share their religious beliefs. One great example of that is the Puritans who founded Massachusetts Bay Colony. They promptly established Massachusetts Bay Colony as a Puritan community and were clicking along very happily until a guy named Roger Williams moved there in 1631. Roger Williams began to attack them for using civil authority to enforce the Ten Commandments and other religious doctrines, and also publicly criticized them for cheating the Indians, which the otherwise very kind and loving Puritans were only too happy to do. Well, Mr. Williams' radical ideas did not go over very well. One might say they flew like a lead balloon. And in the winter of 1635, he was expelled from Massachusetts Bay Colony and headed south into a brutal New England winter to found what is today the small island state of Rhode Island. As he left, he penned into history something that has since been come to be viewed as black letter American constitutional law. He said there must ever be a wall of separation between church and state. Rhode Island was founded on that principle and went on to practice what it preached by becoming home to the first Jewish synagogue in the New World. And in 1790, President George Washington echoed Williams' sentiment in a letter to that very synagogue in Rhode Island, the Toro Synagogue of Newport. He said, "All alike possess liberty of conscience. The government of the United States gives bigotry no sanction and no assistance to persecution." Another of the framers of the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson, in his 1802 letter to the Danbury Baptist Association, exactly echoed Williams' sentiments. One might even say he plagiarized them. "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence the First Amendment, which," and here comes the plagiarized phrase, "built a wall of separation between church and state." Despite these grand sentiments, well into the 1840s, most of the New England states had, in fact, state-established religions and state-established churches. In 1854, for example, a Catholic girl was expelled from Maine's state-run school for refusing to read Scripture from the Protestant King James Version of the Bible as opposed to the Catholic translation. Her expulsion was ultimately upheld by the Maine Supreme Court. Well, the issue came to a head finally in 1878 when a religious, quote-unquote, sect, or so-called sect, interestingly enough, with its birthplace at almost the same time and place as Adventism, found one of its more outre religious practices under legal fire. In fact, it is worth noting that Hill Cumorah, the religious birthplace of the Latter-day Saint Church, is located a bare 20 miles from the Hiram Edson Farm in Rochester, New York, and it is at the Hiram Edson Farm where Seventh-day Adventism's 5S doctrines, the Sabbath, the sanctuary, the state of the dead, the spirit of prophecy, and the second coming, all either found their birth or came together at that farm to become what is today the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Well, by 1878, the LDS Church required believers to practice what Brigham Young, their prophet, called plural marriage. The U.S. government didn't like that very much and outlawed polygamy. And here now is the stage set for a trial of the wall of separation principle enunciated by Messrs. William Washington and Jefferson. In Reynolds versus United States, Mr. Reynolds was criminally charged with polygamy. He defended himself on the basis that he was exercising his First Amendment right to free exercise of his religious beliefs. The Supreme Court rejected his argument, but in the process adopted President Jefferson's wall of separation metaphor, stating as follows. It, quote, may be accepted almost as an authoritative declaration of the scope and effect of the First Amendment. Our modern understanding of the wall of separation was framed by Justice Hugo Black in two companion cases in 1947 and 1948. Everson versus Board of Education and McCollum versus Board of Education. Everson incorporated the First Amendment to the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. I'll come back to that in a moment. And McCollum versus Board of Education held that separate religious classes during the school day were permissible if there was a permission slip from the parents. And the case disallowed that, said that separate religious classes during the school day were impermissible because of the wall of separation. In those two cases, the court explicitly adopted the wall of separation and stated that religion has no place in public life. Now, what do I mean when I say that Everson incorporated the First Amendment to the states? Prior to the Civil War, the Constitution was and still is seen to create a system of limited federal government. This is basic civics, understanding that the federal government has no power to regulate anything unless it is expressly given authority by the Constitution to do so. For instance, the power to tax, the power to declare war, and so forth, the power to regulate interstate commerce. After the Civil War, the problem that the Constitution faced is that the nation had just fought a long and incredibly bloody civil war to end slavery, but outlawing slavery was not permitted under, as it was then understood by the Constitution, the limited reach of the Constitution, because the Constitution had been interpreted by the Supreme Court as applying only to the federal government. So the restrictions contained in the First Amendment on neither prohibiting the free exercise of religion or establishing a state religion were held to apply only to limit the federal government from doing that. They did not apply to limit the individual states in either of those areas. Now, because of the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments were passed outlawing slavery, guaranteeing to every citizen the due process of law, and so forth. And as part of that, the Supreme Court, after the Civil War, began to go through the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution and saying, is, for instance, freedom of religion fundamental to due process of law such that the same limitations that apply to the federal government should be applied to the state governments as well? And in a series of cases, interestingly enough, culminating just last year and this year with the rather notorious Second Amendment decisions that said that the Second Amendment guarantee of the right of the people to keep and bear arms applies to the states as well. The first 10 amendments in most part, have been incorporated to the states such that their restrictions now restrict the state as well. And having said that, keep that thought in mind, because that is not the last thought or the last conclusion on the issue of incorporation. McCollum stands for the proposition that religion cannot be taught in public schools, even if it's on the student's own time and with the permission of their parents to do so. With that background, and understanding that the First Amendment now generally applies to both state and federal governments, let's talk about the current status of constitutional protections for the wall of separation envisioned by President Jefferson. The First Amendment reads like this: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That gives us two components to the First Amendment guarantees of the United States Constitution. The first is the so-called Free Exercise Clause. The second prohibits the establishment of any one religion over another one. Now, there is a fundamental and inescapable incompatibility between those two clauses, which may not at first appear completely obvious. Let me explain it to you. If we impose a tax on churches, the same way as we do on corporations or individuals, and if every dollar that you put into the collection plate today was subject to a 30% tax, what effect might that have on different organized religions, and which of these clauses of the Constitution might be impacted? They both would be impacted. Let's talk about that for a minute. To answer the obvious and easy question of what effect would it have, in the words of the Supreme Court, the power to tax carries with it the power to embarrass and destroy. Anytime you impose a tax on something, you are deterring and discouraging whatever the conduct may be. That's why we have the so-called sin taxes. You buy sinful products, alcohol, tobacco, you pay a tax on them. Why? Because we're trying to discourage people from doing that. So if we impose a tax on churches, particularly for poorer denominations or even poorer churches of a particular denomination in an economically disadvantaged community, you're making it harder for them to freely exercise their religious beliefs by taxing and thereby discouraging them gathering together as a group of believers. But what if you don't tax churches? You're encouraging them and thereby potentially violating the Establishment Clause by encouraging the establishment of certain religious denominations. Now, the further problem comes with that. How do you determine what's a righteous church that shouldn't be taxed, and one, for instance, that worships Satan and sacrifices small children that perhaps shouldn't be treated as a legitimate institution or a legitimate church? Now, case law has developed under both of these clauses, and I'm going to talk to you for just a little bit this morning about the status of freedom of religion in this country under both clauses of the Constitution. How many people here this morning, for instance, think that the U.S. Constitution prohibits government from establishing a religion? How many people think that funding of private institutions, or might I say, private religious institutions, constitutes establishing a religion? Okay. Here's the story. In the beginning of time, there was a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman. And Lemon versus Kurtzman, and we're going to focus in first on the second protection here, the Establishment Clause. In Lemon versus Kurtzman, the state of Pennsylvania had a law that allowed the state to reimburse non-public schools for certain educational expenses. Most of those schools were Catholic, and the payments went for teachers' salaries, textbooks, and school materials. Under the Lemon test enunciated in that case, there are four standards that a public funding measure has to meet in order to satisfy the Lemon test and not be deemed to be an establishment. There must be, first, a legitimate secular purpose to the education. There must be no primary effect of advancing or inhibiting religion. And number three, there must be no excessive entanglement with religion in order for the funding to be legitimate. Now, the Lemon test is still good law, barely. Nominally applying the Lemon factors, a majority of the Supreme Court in 2002 held that private Ohio schools could take federal money through a voucher plan. They could receive, in other words, students would receive a voucher, as most of you are aware. They could spend that either at a public school or at a private school. And the court, nominally genuflecting towards Lemon, basically allowed federal money to go towards private secular educational expenses. What's the problem potentially with that? Where goes federal money? There goes federal control. One unique feature of the Ohio bill is that no school that received the money could teach pervasively sectarian doctrines or anything that would tend to encourage hate or dislike of another religion. So, for instance, a Zionist school that believes that a state of Israel should be established might or might not qualify under the voucher program, and once it has the money, the federal government has the ability to say you can't do this, 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 and this in your educational program, or you will no longer get our vouchers. In a ringing dissent from that opinion, now retired Justice John Paul Stevens disagreed with the majority and said, whenever we remove a brick from the wall that was designed to separate religion and government, we weaken the foundation of our democracy. Justice Souter openly opined in a separate dissent that the court's holding in Zelman v. Simmons-Harris, that's the Ohio school voucher case, could not be rationalized with Everson versus Board of Education. Many constitutional scholars believe that the Zelman case spells the death knell of any effective enforcement of the Establishment Clause. It has opened the door that was previously closed by Lemon versus Kurtzman, and in a follow-on decision named Romer, the court has upheld a restriction on schools receiving public grant money that does not allow public grant money to go to schools that are pervasively sectarian. So for federal money to go to a pervasively sectarian school, which is prohibited under the Romer case, would, in the court's opinion, be an impermissible establishment of religion, which kind of makes sense, doesn't it? So, theoretically, despite the worries over Zelman v. Simmons-Harris, there's still the Romer standard that says you can't use federal money at a pervasively sectarian school. That test still stands, but it is under active attack. Just a few years ago, in Columbia Union College versus Clark, Columbia Union College sued the state of Maryland, alleging that it was not pervasively sectarian. It was therefore, in CUC's view, entitled to federal money. Columbia Union College lost in the federal district court. They appealed to the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit held that requiring students to attend Vespers, discriminating in hiring in favor, for instance, in your theology department, of people that actually belong to your religion, offering a course of theological instruction was not pervasively sectarian. The Fourth Circuit held in favor of Columbia Union College. The Supreme Court denied certiorari, but Justice Thomas said that he felt the entire Romer and Lemon standards were incorrect and that the court would soon have to repeal them. Justice Thomas also suggested that the Establishment Clause was, by its terms, limited to Congress and thus wrongly incorporated to the states to begin with. So there is an active school of thought in the Supreme Court that, first of all, the Establishment Clause, this is the Elk Grove case, the Establishment Clause shouldn't even be incorporated to the states. Remember, I told you, hold that thought in mind. There's still some disagreement on that. There's a school of, admittedly a minority school of thought, but a school of thought in the Supreme Court that says you shouldn't even apply the Establishment Clause to the states, and states should be allowed to establish whatever religion they want. So I guess Pennsylvania could become Amish, Massachusetts could become Catholic, and we here in California would be, I don't know, Rastafarian or something. There's one school of thought, and you know, while the pervasively sectarian test is out there in Romer and actually makes a lot of sense, there are a number of schools, including this one, I think it's back in the D.C. area somewhere, named Columbia Union College, that is actively trying to fight to, if not overturn the standard, establish that there is really no such thing as pervasive sectarianism when it comes to higher education. End result and conclusion is that the Establishment Clause, while still with us, is shaky, is under attack, and really does not provide the level of wall or the density of wall that many of us might have thought from saying government may not establish religion. That leaves us with, number one, the Free Exercise Clause. Let's talk about where the Free Exercise Clause stands today. The Free Exercise Clause has an interesting history. In Sherbert versus Verner, 1963, in South Carolina, a young lady, a Seventh-day Adventist lady, refused to go to work on Saturday, on Sabbath. And she went down to the unemployment benefits office in South Carolina and said, you know, I really think I should get unemployment benefits because my employer said, well, you won't work on Saturday and you won't work on the Lord's Day. What good are you? You're fired. And she went to the unemployment office. The unemployment office said, well, that makes perfect sense to us. We ain't going to give you benefits neither. And she didn't like that very much, so she did a smart thing. She went out and hired a lawyer. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in 1963 held that government interference with the free exercise of religion by, for instance, not giving people unemployment benefits when they are fired for exercising their religious beliefs is subject to a constitutional standard of review known as heightened scrutiny. Now, without trying to turn you into constitutional law scholars, let me cut to the chase and say that heightened scrutiny means the government loses. Isn't that wonderful? Well, moving back to the concept of the Rastafarians among us, that is not the end of the story. In the 1980s, this is one of my favorite cases, there were these two gentlemen that were drug counselors, Mr. Black and Mr. Smith, in the state of Oregon, and they were Native Americans. And the Native American religion is an existential, experiential religion where you don't really have a holy text that you read. There's no Bible, there's no Quran, there's no Bhagavad Gita, there's just visions. You go out and the Great Spirit gives you visions, and that's your religion. Well, apparently the Great Spirit every once in a while needs some help, and so they drink this peyote tea. Now, anybody here read Doug Batchelor's book about when he was living in the cave over Palm Springs? You remember the peyote story where he ran down into Palm Springs telling them that the Arabs were coming stark naked? Well, he did that, most of you may not remember this, after a bad trip on peyote. So, they go off to their powwow over the weekend. They have their peyote tea. Everything's wonderful. They come back on Monday morning. The boss says, good news, guys. This is your lucky day for the random drug test. Well, they fail it, of course. They're fired. They hire another lawyer who pulls out his law book and says, no worries, heightened scrutiny, Sherbert versus Verner, you win. They went to the Supreme Court, and in 1990, Chief Justice Rehnquist, writing for the court, said, actually, we were wrong in Sherbert versus Verner. The correct standard should be rational basis, which means that if the government has a rational basis, such as you're a drug counselor, you shouldn't be experimenting with the stuff you're telling the kids not to do. Even if you do have a religious reason for it, This is the Smith case. The government can discriminate against you on that basis. Now, again, there's a lot of constitutional scholarship and ink spilled on the topic of what is the difference between rational basis and heightened scrutiny. Again, let me make it simple for you. Rational basis equals the government wins. All right. The Congress of the United States responded to the Smith case in 1993 with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that purported to basically overrule Smith. And in one of these really interesting height measuring contests between the Congress, which sits here, and then right across the street is the Supreme Court, which sits here, Congress said, you can't do that. We're the Congress. We'll change the law. And it went back to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court took one look at the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and said, sorry, we're the Supreme Court. We interpret the Constitution. It's still unconstitutional. You lose. The U.S. Supreme Court has limited the RFRA to federal laws only with City of Bernie v. Flores and Gonzalez versus UDV, which was decided in 2006. Again, Gonzalez involved hallucinogenic tea. It seems to be a popular Supreme Court theme when it comes to religious liberty. Well, at the basic end of the day, what do we take from this? The government is now restricted in prohibiting free exercise only by a standard that says so long as they have a rational basis for doing so, they can. There is no federal constitutional protection after City of Bernie v. Flores at the state level, and only legislative protection under the RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, at the federal level. And, of course, as you know, that law can be changed by act of Congress. There is no constitutional no realistic constitutional constraint at the federal or state level. Okay, my time grows short. Let's open the Word and wrap up. Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21, verse 25. It's evening in Jesus' life, and he's sitting on the Mount of Olives looking out over that beautiful, sparkling city of Jerusalem, and his disciples come to him and they say, Lord, what will be the signs of your coming and of the end of the world? And the Lord responds. He says, there will be signs in the sun, moon, and stars. Upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. And if you're reading along in the NIV version, which is probably the best in this instance translation you'll find of the original Greek, it goes on and says, men will faint with what? Men will faint with terror. Well, the question is, what happens in a time of fear, a time the Bible predicts will have grown men fainting from terror? I suggest to you that without black-letter constitutional protection, the religious and civil freedoms enjoyed in this country survive merely through the goodwill of the majority of Americans. A Constitution's role is and always must be to protect the minority from the majority. And without that protection, without the same strength of black-letter constitutional protection that was enjoyed for much of the 20th century, America is entering the 21st century with a freedom of religion enjoyed in large part because a majority of Americans still think it is a good idea. And that is a formidable factor in favor of continued religious and civil freedom in this country. I do not mean to suggest anything to the contrary. Americans are a good people with large hearts and a strong sense of right and wrong. Never, ever underestimate the goodness and the greatness of Americans. The Austrian admiral who held Kostya did. A guy named Adolf Schickelgruber, who later changed his name to Hitler, did. Saddam Hussein did. All are remembered only as extraneous metaphors for the price Americans are willing to pay for the blessing of freedom. But as great as this country is, we have shown a willingness in times past to sacrifice liberty on the altar of freedom from fear. I don't have time to talk to you about Merriman, Korematsu, and Minersville v. Gobitis. Suffice it to say that in times of crisis, this country has, and the Supreme Court has approved this country, suspending the writ of habeas corpus, which is the most powerful guarantee in the English and American jurisprudence and legal system to the rights of the individual. This country has discriminated against Jehovah's Witness students who refused to salute the flag, and the Supreme Court's upheld it. This country has interred Japanese Americans by the tens of thousands, and this country has upheld it. When the time of trouble foreseen by Jesus comes upon us, we will be forced, as Christians and Americans, to decide what it means to guarantee freedom to every citizen in our homes, our schools, and our places of worship. And those can be hard choices to make, particularly in a time when terrorists wrap themselves in the very protections they seek to destroy. But I wish to leave you with two thoughts this morning, not of discouragement, but of hope. The first is, as Paul Harvey would have said, the rest of the story. As Christians, we have no reason to be afraid because we know how the story ends. Just keep reading right after the Lord's prediction of a time of trouble. The very next verse is, "They shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And when these things begin to come to pass, you should do what? Look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh." The last reason I'll leave you with that gives me great confidence for the future of ourselves and for this great nation is memories. I began this morning by remembering a day that is now history to many, but for me is still as fresh in memory as the day it happened. When I close my eyes, I can still see the last moments of Flight 77. I can hear the screams of the wounded, and I can feel the heat of burning JP-4 on my arms. But I can also remember other things from that day. The sight of the first F-16 Charlie flying through the smoke that was the headstone for 125 of my comrades. The sight of America rebuilding just hours after the attack, and the strains of God Bless America being sung by our congressional representatives that evening. You see, sacrifice for others is nothing new for Americans. When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in the same building in which the Constitution was drafted, they did a very bold thing. 56 ordinary citizens penned their names on a document declaring war on the most powerful military on earth. And those men were not penniless revolutionaries, long on dreams and short on prospects. 24 were lawyers and judges, 11 were merchants, 9 were farmers with large landholdings. Most had achieved every material success life could offer. But they put it all on the line for freedom. And of those men who signed, John Hart was driven from the side of his terminally ill wife and had to live for more than a year on the run, hiding in the forest in the caves. And when he finally could return, his wife was dead and his children were gone. He never saw them again, his property destroyed. He died of a broken heart. Carter Braxton of Virginia had to sell all of his ships to pay his debts and died penniless in rags. So it was with Ellery, Clymer, Hull, Walton, Gwinnett, Rutledge, Morris, Livingston, and Middleton. Mr. Nelson, learning that General Cornwallis was using his home as a headquarters, begged on General Washington to fire on it and destroy his home, and that man died bankrupt. Despite the cost, there is not one historical record of any of those men ever expressing bitterness or regret for the choice they made. 56 ordinary citizens founded a nation that grew from sea to shining sea. 300 million people, over 100,000 of them today at this moment, serving around the world in harm's way, fighting for somebody else's freedom. Fighting for others is, in fact, a sacred American tradition. In the 20th century, America fought 7 wars for others' freedoms, and as we move into the 21st, we are engaged in 2. America has always stood and must always stand for liberty, liberty of conscience, liberty of religion, liberty of speech. We are indeed a city upon a hill. The eyes of the world are on us and on this great nation. And in times of danger and fear, I think every American, every Seventh-day Adventist, every Christian has a chance to show the world the size of our hearts and the importance of the freedom we go into harm's way to preserve. By our thoughts, by our acts, by genuine Christian generosity and acceptance of others unlike ourselves, we can show the world there is nothing more valuable than the rights of everyone to life, liberty, and happiness. That is the miracle of America. It is for our age, for this day especially, 9 years later, and for every day to come, this country's gift to the world. May God bless each of you, and may God continue to bless the United States. Thank you. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to review the blessing of living in this, the most special of nations. May it always remind us of your love and your blessing for us. May we take that, may it inspire us, and may we share it with others. In Jesus' name, amen.